Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed edition of Modern Day Philosophers. I am your host. I am Danny Lobel. You are the listeners. You are whoever you are, aren't you? I think you are. And you're out there somewhere listening to this show, and I appreciate you doing so. Please donate, if you can, to moderndayphilosophers.net. There's a donate button there. And keep the show going. It is supported by listeners like you. And it is also supported by listeners who are not like you. Listeners who sponsor the episodes, like Tent. Tent is Encounters with Jewish Culture. They offer week-long residencies for creative 20-something-year-olds. They've got programs in food, fashion, journalism, creative writing, and a bunch of other topics. And the deadline for their comedy program is coming up soon. Go to tentsite.org for more details. And by the way, I'm a proud alum of Tent Comedy myself. I did it last year, even though I'm not usually a fan of these kinds of things. It was really great, fun, even enlightening. They will feed you, which I'm always a fan of, and they will put you up, which is also cool. And it doesn't cost you anything. They cover your meals, your tickets to shows, workshops, classes. It's really cool. If you're into the history of Jews and comedy, it doesn't get better than this. You just need to go to LA if you're not there already. In the program last year, we did an improv workshop at the Groundlings with Michaela Watkins. We did comedy writing workshops with Yoni Brenner, who writes for The New Yorker, Shouts and Murmurs section. We talked with Ken Levine, who's written for MASH and The Jeffersons and The Simpsons. And we saw performances by Jeff Garlin and Sarah Silverman, Tig Notaro, Pete Holmes, and many others. We learned a lot about history of Jews. We learned about the old Lower East Side. Pretty cool stuff. And like I said, it's not just comedy. They have programs for people interested in food journalism, creative writing, and many more things. You don't have to be obsessed with Jewish stuff to do Tent. You can just be curious. There's no catch, except for the fact that there are only 20 spots in each program, and the deadlines are coming up soon. So check out tentsite.org for more details. Check that out. And I'm also proud to tell you that this week's episode is also brought to you by Stand Up Records. Stand Up Records presents standupcrap.com. Standupcrap.com is where you can go. You can go to standupcrap.com and you can pick up fantastic records from comedians like Marc Maron, Louis Black, Maria Bamford, Brendan Burns, and, well, me, Danny Lobel. You can go pick up my album, Some Kind of Comedian. I'm proud to be on their label, and I'm happy that Mr. Dan Schlissel has kept this show going yet another episode. Thank you very much, Dan Schlissel. Go to standupcrap.com, pick up CDs, vinyls, DVDs, T-shirts, and lots more merchandise from the leading, number one, most prolific comedy label out there, standupcrap.com. Go there today. And if you can't do today, tomorrow. But come on. You got to be able to fit it in either today or tomorrow. Okay. It's been quite a week. Here's a good story. I like to give you a little tidbit from the week. Went with my buddy Rick Wood, who's a very funny comic I met out here in LA. We go to garage sales sometimes on a Sunday. It's a fun thing to do. Well, we stopped off at a coffee bean, and I needed to use the bathroom, and I noticed there was a long line. So I went next door. There was a bagel place. I said, can I use the bathroom? They said, we don't have a bathroom. I was like, oh, I'm getting desperate. So I go to the other side of the coffee bean, and there's a fancy brunch place. And I noticed there's the hostess at the greeting stand, which is generally where they stand, at the greeting stand. And it's also where they stop people from going to the bathroom, in my experience, who are not customers or patrons of the restaurant. So I devised a plan very quickly in my head. I decided to pretend to make eye contact with a table in the back of the room. So when I walked up to her, I wasn't looking at her, I was looking at the table, and I was fake waving to nobody. And she didn't think anything of it, so I just continued past her stand. So I get to the back area where there's a line for the bathroom. There's someone in the bathroom, then there's one guy ahead of me online, and me. And the guy, he's like a real Jersey tough guy. I don't even know who let him into LA. You never see guys like this in LA. This is like an East Coast guy. I know them. I know them from being one. And he's mad. And the guy, he goes, can you freaking believe this? Can you freaking believe this? We gotta wait for the bathroom in a fancy restaurant like this? Can you freaking believe I gotta wait while some asshole's in there that probably didn't even pay to come into the restaurant? Probably right off of the street. You know, that's the problem with these places. He goes, they just let, and by the way, there's no way he could have known that how I came to be in that part of the restaurant, just the way it was set up. He goes, people, you know, I bet they don't have good security here. I bet they're just letting any shithead in off the street. They need to use the bathroom, and they probably just let him in. While people like me and you have to pay a ton of money and sit down, and then we have to wait for these people who aren't even part of the restaurant to use the bathroom. And I go, yes, sir, you're absolutely right. I just start agreeing with him. I go, you're right. It's an outrage. It's shocking. Shocking. I bet you they do have bad security. He goes, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying so. Thank you for agreeing with me, because I am outraged about this, and nobody ever agrees with me about this. But I'm telling you, this should be stopped. They just let anybody in off the street. I go, anybody. They're probably letting in just anyone. Oh, I just need to use a bathroom. First, just go ahead. They're probably encouraging people to come in. Hey, you need to use the bathroom? People are like, I don't even know, maybe. Nah, just come in and use it. You never know. You might need to go. He goes, you're right. Something needs to be done. I go, yeah, we should be talking to the upper management. We need to protest. This is an outrage. And then we hear the toilet flush. The guy who's in the bathroom is obviously done. And he gets out, and the guy says to me, he goes, you get me, man, you get me. He goes, hey, you need to go ahead of me? I go, yeah, absolutely. And I go ahead of him. I go ahead of him into the bathroom. I'm exactly the guy he's complaining about. It was like a small victory for me, because I'm absolutely against that, everything that he was saying. He was just so damn intimidating, I decided to agree with him. But I was anybody who should use a bathroom, in my opinion, should be allowed to use a bathroom. I think it's inhumane to restrict people who need to use a bathroom from using it. And my friend said, when I told him the story, he said the only thing that would have been funnier was if I used the last of the toilet paper in there, and then he needed to use it, and he got it. Oh, my God. Well, it was an absolute pleasure getting to talk to Carl Reiner, and you're going to get to hear that in a second. And the most amazing thing was that after doing the interview, he gave me a call a few days later and invited me for what was an incredible experience, where I got to spend an evening with him and Mel Brooks. And that's a whole nother story onto itself that maybe I'll tell at some other time. But there's a lot for me to say about it. And to be sitting with these two heroes of mine was, it was more than just special. I'll tell you that. It was incredibly meaningful to me. And we had a wonderful time, and we talked a lot, and we talked about music. And at the end, Carl gave me some CDs that his late wife Estelle Reiner had recorded. And I've been listening to them all week, and they're just absolutely wonderful. And they're inspiring. They're so inspiring, especially because of the fact that she started her singing career in her 60s and had a career for over 30 years. And if that's not motivation for anybody out there, that if you have a dream that you want to follow, that it's not too late, you better go and do it. Well, nothing will be, because I sometimes get down about the fact that I'm 31 and I see guys who are starting out in their teens as comedians and they're shooting up to success, and I feel old. And I'm not old, I'm young. And I've always dreamt of being on Saturday Night Live, and sometimes I think, well, that dream can't be anymore. I'm 31, it's too late. And I gotta tell you something, this really recharged my battery. And it really made me think, you know what, I'm gonna go for it. I'm gonna figure this out. I'm in this eating disorder program now. I'm gonna lose some weight. I'm gonna sharpen up my character showcase. And I'm going to audition for Saturday Night Live. I'll do it. And I'll get on it. And if I don't get on it, I'll do something else. I'll get on another sketch show. Of course, there's nothing like Saturday Night Live, but I will get on a sketch show. I'm going to make things happen. I'm only 31 years old. I'm a kid, for crying out loud. And I found Estelle Reiner's CDs to be incredibly inspiring, and I'm going to play a song from one of her CDs for you at the end of the show. Okay, everybody, without further ado, my talk with Carl Reiner. Well, except for the intro song, that's a slight further ado. But other than that, coming up right now, my talk with Carl Reiner. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel!
Modern Day Philosophers.
It's an honor to be here. It's wonderful to meet you.
So say you.
All right. So arguing?
No, I'm happy to be any place. You know, when you get to be 92, you're just happy that your brain is working enough so that you make sense of words that come into your head.
And your impressions are so spot on.
They used to be good. Every young comedian uses impressions to get into to put their foot in the door. Everybody wants to hear about the great stars, and you give them a taste of it.
I think more your generation than mine were very big on impressions, comedians.
Absolutely. You don't hear them now. There are only one or two really good impressionists around these days.
Do you think it became a taboo, or what do you think it is?
I have no idea, Governor.
Really?
I have no idea. I also have no idea why people are so enamored of these rappers, and they don't say very much, but they say a lot. They use a lot of words to say nothing. and I would rather hear pencils. I'd rather hear a song with lyrics.
I guess that's why not too many of them tweet. You don't see too many rappers on Twitter.
I tweet a lot. I tweet every day.
I enjoy your tweets.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
That's good. Well, that's one of the things that tweet teaches you, succinctness.
Yeah. As a writer for so many years, is that a skill that you had already crafted before Twitter, I imagine?
I guess, yes. I realized that I didn't even know I was a writer until the book started coming out. I mean, I think I became a writer because in the Army, I was separated from my wife for almost two and a half, three years. And we wrote every day. And I wrote 4 or 5 page letters a day. Once I wrote her 17 letters of 6 pages in one day. And I think that's how I started to become a writer.
Do you think emails nowadays have the same effect as letters or no?
Not at all.
So
no, they're not as personal and not as long and there's not, you know, this, and it's not, a phone call is better.
See, I email my girlfriend all the time, but I don't think we have that strong of a written connection as I would if we wrote actual letters.
Try going to the dinner together.
I'm working on it.
Yes.
I have a savings fund. About 3 years from now, I ought to be able to take her to dinner. I enjoyed the poem you wrote in the book. You wrote a poem.
Ode to the Buttocks Bountiful, yes.
Yeah. It reminded me of Robbie Burns' Ode to a Mouse.
I don't know that.
No?
No.
You know Robert Burns?
I know all Robert Burns.
You don't know? Oh, we sleekit curin timorous beastie. Oh, what a panic in thy breastie.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yanina runaway sahisti. We bickering brattle. I would be kissed to come and cheese thee. That's about as much as I can remember.
And you do it very well. You're a good performer.
Oh, thank you. Well, going back to the book being called I Just Remembered, the follow-up to I Remember Me.
By the way, I'm doing another book now. I'm about 40 pages into it. It's called What I Had Forgotten. And I'm really 40 pages into it, and I have at least a dozen more chapters. I've written nine chapters.
I imagine you could do many, many more of these.
Well, you have to hang around to do them.
Right.
Yes.
Well.
92, by the way, I worked my, you know, 92 is a long time, but not long enough. So I've decided to find out how many nanoseconds I've lived and how many nanoseconds I will live till 94. If I go at 94, how many nanoseconds I have? I have it written down. It's very interesting.
And you picked 94 because of Estelle?
Estelle left at 94,
right.
Yes. And she was 8 years older than me, so this year's her 100th, would have been her 100th year.
Right.
I look at every morning I wake up and I watch, first thing I read is the obits to see what age people are going in. Whether they're mostly younger than I am. Today there were a couple of 100-year-olds. That was very heartening.
Right. Do you think if the ages just got higher and higher, you'd have more and more hope? Is that what you're...
Yes, you do. Absolutely. Well, you know, the mean age during the middle ages was 40 years old, 42, 43. Mm-hmm. And we've got it up to around 70 or 80 now.
How, if you could live to be any age, how old would you want to live?
As long as I'm functioning mentally, I think it'd be all right. Once things start to hurt and you have trouble maneuvering, if you fall down a lot, you know, but once your while your brain is working, it seems you want to hang around. And when there are good programs to be seen still on television, tonight there are a couple I want to see.
So as long as TV is good and the mind is working.
Tonight, I just taped it. I just TiVo'd it. My favorite performer of all, one of my all-time performers, Audra McDonald, is on Letterman tonight. And I'm just hoping she does a piece from her new thing about Billie Holiday. My wife was enamored of Billie Holiday, and I have a piece in my book about Billie. I think it's in this book.
Oh, yes.
Yes, yes. You, how do you know?
I read the book.
Oh, you read the... Oh, you. That's right. You did. Yeah, that's it. It is in this book.
You know what I liked? You mentioned that you picked up a fascination for Irish music.
Yes. I'll sing a song for you if you like.
Oh, I'd love it.
It's right now, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my father had a friend named Max Kalfas. He was a German-Jewish gentleman. And he had a brother called John Calvin, who sang on WRA radio in New York. Every Saturday, he had a 15-minute show. And he'd say, and here's a song me mother taught me when I was in me mother's knee. And he'd sing an Irish song. And I love those songs. And one of the first songs I remember is Tumble Down Shack and Athlone. And I said to my father, I want to be an Irish tenor. He said, well, you can't. You're Jewish. I said, but he's an Irish tenor. And he's, you can be a Jewish singer singing Irish songs. So that's what I hope to become someday. I'm a long way from home, and it's there that I'd roam to Lough Erin far over the sea. Oh, me heart, it is there where the skies are so fair and Lough Erin is calling me. There are eyes that are sad as they watch for a lad from the tumble-down shack in Athlone, and I pray for the day I'll be sailing away to Lough Erin, me mother, me home. Oh, I want to go back to that tumble-down shack where the bright roses bloom round the door, just to pillow me head on me old trundle bed, just to hear me dear mother once more. There's a bright guiding light guiding me home tonight, down the long road of white cobblestone, down the road that leads back to that tumble-down shack, to that tumble-down shack in Athlone.
All right, that's beautiful.
Go. See that?
You know, that I brought it up because we have this in common. When I was a kid, I said the same thing to my dad. I'm not kidding. I thought it was a very interesting connection that we shared. I also wanted to be an Irish tenor.
Well, you know, there was that particular song, by the way, was sung by almost everybody in the world, starting with John McCormick way back, going to Bing Crosby. Everybody recorded that song.
Well, you did a beautiful rendition.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, I used to listen to the Clancy Brothers and memorize the...
Oh, really?
Do you want to hear one?
Yes.
All right. There was Johnny McAldoo and McGee and me, and a couple or two or three went to spree one day. We had a bup or two, which we knew out of blue, and the beer and whiskey flew, and we all felt gay. We visited McKen's, McLemann's, Humpty Dan's. We then went into Swan's, our stomachs were to pack. We ordered out a feed, which indeed we did need, and we finished it with speed, but we still felt slack. Johnny McAldoo turned a red, white, and blue, as a plate of Irish stew he soon put out of sight. He shouted out in core with a roar for some more that he'd never felt before, such a keen appetite. He ordered eggs and ham, bread and jam, what a cram. Him we couldn't tram, though we tried a level best, for no matter what they brought, cold or hot, matter not. Went down him like a shot, and he still stood the test. Swallowed tripe and lard, by the yard we get scarred. We thought it might go hard when the waiter brought the bill. We told him to give o'er, but he swore he could lure twice as much again and more before he'd had his fill. He nearly supped a trough full of brass and McGraw. He'll devour the tablecloth if he'd own all him in. When the waiter brought the charge, McAldoo felt so large. He began to scald and barge, and his blood went in fire. He began to curse and swear, tear his hair in despair, and to finish the affair, called the shopman a liar. Shopman he threw out, and no doubt he'd a claddle meckledo. He kicked about like an old football, tarted up his clothes, broke his nose, I suppose. He'd have killed him in a few blows in no time at all. Meckledo began to howl and to growl, by me soul. He threw an empty ball at the shopkeeper's head. He hit poor Mickey Finn, peeled the skin from his chin, and a rupture did begin, and we all fought and bled. The peelers did arrive, man alive for a five, and thus it made a drive for us all to march away. We paid for all the meat that we ate, stood a treat, and went home to ruminate on the spree that day.
Now that is one beautiful rendition of a song I've never heard before. You win hands down. You win first prize, and I got ninth.
You know what I realized?
And only two of us are competing.
Well, no, I think you win first prize, but I'll tell you what.
No, that was brilliantly done, brilliantly done.
I realized that there's no other use for me knowing that song in my whole life. It had to serve a purpose that I'd remembered it. And all these years have gone by, and it's never served me any purpose until I realized Carl Reiner and I both share an affinity for this.
You know, I had a chat with Ferguson on the show, and I was saying that there was a whole thing about one of my favorite human beings that ever lived was Pete Seeger, mm-hmm. a great, great, great man. I met him in Hawaii once, and we were talking about folk songs. He sang for 100,000 people, and he got them all to sing along. He gave them the lyrics, and they sang them back. And it was thrilling. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And we're talking about folk songs. He says, you know, a lot of folk songs are mainly the ones from the little towns. He says, guys used to get together. They're all bawdy. They're very bawdy. And he sang me one of the bawdiest songs I've ever heard, The Ball of Bellamore. Have you ever heard?
No.
I told Ferguson about that, and he says, oh, you can't sing that on this show. Oh, no, you can't. But he forced me to sing it so he could say, don't sing that, don't sing that. And I sang it up to the rhymes, but the rhymes were so dirty that you don't have to say what the rhyme was. You knew what it was. Uh-huh. It's going to be the dirtiest thing ever.
Right. Can I get a piece?
Certainly, I'll give you a piece, but I won't go to the rhymes. They're ladies first.
Yeah.
Oh, have you heard the story of the Ball of Bellamore? 24 prostitutes lying on the floor singing, who'll do you this time? Who'll do you new? The man who did you last time, he cannot do you new. The old fat maiden, she was there, she was in a state of fits, swinging from the chandelier and landing on her bing doodly bing. Anyway, it goes like that. There are four more lyrics like that. Each get worse and worse and worse. There was screwing in, there was fucking nice, in the parlor and fucking in the stick. You can hardly hear the music for the swishing of that. I know he was, but he forced me to sing it, and he kept saying, don't do that.
Right, right.
And I can't wait to see if he puts that on the air or he just did it for a studio audience.
How many late night show appearances do you think you've done in your lifetime?
91,674.
Wow, you have it right.
Yes.
Right down to
We're 65. I just remembered I did one on Tavis Smiley, which is coming on this Friday.
Well, what's the trick to being great on these talk shows?
Be yourself. Don't try to be anybody else or be a good impersonator. You know, you have something worth selling, so you're there for a purpose usually. I remember going on Carson a few times and having nothing to sell. Just because he needed somebody calling. I said, I have nothing to sell. Come on anyway, he said.
Do you get nerves when you go on TV?
Not really.
Did you ever?
Yeah, the proper amount of nerves. Yeah, you just worry that you don't trip or something. But no, when you go on with people you trust, you know they're going to ask you the. It's when you go on with somebody who doesn't know how to interview that it makes it tough. Then you just take it over and go.
Right. You never get self-conscious?
Only if my fly is open, and they find out later.
Yeah. You know, when I'm on stage, I always get paranoid my fly is open. At some point when I'm on stage, I'm not kidding you. Almost every time I've done a show where it's like an hour-long show, at some point in the show, I'm thinking, I hope my fly is not open.
That's why is it going so well?
Yeah.
Well, you see where look at the people's eyes. See if their eyes are on your forehead or they're on your crotch.
It's a good trick.
Yes.
What if they're moving around, then you got to be more interesting than the fly. You know, if I'm more interesting than an open fly, then I'm really good. I think that's the trick, maybe, to being the best comedian.
Yes.
You got to go up with an open fly every time till you get so strong that the people can only focus on you and not the fly.
Yeah, that's right. If you have an open fly and you can keep them looking at your face, you're really a great comedian.
That's got to be the secret to it all.
Absolutely.
Yeah. you brought up the song on Ferguson, reminded me of a great story in your book, which was the girl who couldn't pronounce her own name.
Yes, true story. I met her at a USO gathering in Washington, D.C. I just was going to Georgetown to learn to be a French interpreter. So I met her, and she was the first one at the dance, and I was one of the first guys there. She came over to me, and she said her name. She said, "Hi." She said, "My name is Joyce Van." And so she had a middle name, Joyce Jessica Kuntz, she said. And I said, "Just a minute." She repeated it. "What's yours?" And I said, "Karl Reiner." And she said, "Karl Reiner." And she spoke such a thick act, beautiful girl wearing a beautiful dress, long blonde hair, and very, very sweet. And you could see she was a naive person. And I said, "How are you spelling that name?" She says, "How it's pronounced, K-U-N-T-Z. I says, I'm German extraction. My father spoke German. I says, that's pronounced Kunz. She said, "That's silly. Is that no Kunz?"
Which was a very, very soft way of telling her. I thought that was very...
Really, yeah, but I was really serious about it. I wasn't trying to fool her. I said, "You know something?" And I was serious. I said, "If you pronounce the way you're pronouncing it, most of the people are going to take it to mean the female, sexual female, the female sex organ." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Oh, that silliest thing I ever heard, you know." And she wouldn't. And my friend came over, Saul Pomerantz came over to say hello, and she introduced herself as Joyce Kuntz. And he said, he punched me, so, you know, he thought I put her up to it. And the two of us, really, for the rest of the afternoon, or for a good part of it, we convinced her we taught her how to say Kunz. We said, "You're going to get a lot of people giggling at you, and the reason they're giggling is they think you're saying vagina."
You definitely have a part of you that you want to help. You really, I see it in a lot of your stories, is that you do really truly want to help people. The guy with the comb over was another good story.
Yes, right.
Well, two guys. Neil Simon, I thought that was fantastic you cut off his comb over.
Yes, right. No, that was for those who don't know what we're talking about, I have a picture in the book of General MacArthur, who had the best comb over. Comb over means you part your hair near your ear.
Right.
And if you have hair that really should be cut off, you comb it over to make it look like you're covering the bald spot.
Right.
And I was doing the Van Dyke Show at the time and looking for writers to help me. And this young writer submitted one of his, and I said, "I can't read your script." He says, "Why not?" I said, "Because I don't trust you." He said, "Why don't you trust me?"
Right.
"You don't know me." He said, "Yeah, but I'm looking at your hair. That your hair is, you combed over, it's a fake, you know."
Yeah.
"You're probably, you're trying to hide your baldness, and instead of looking at your face, I'm looking at your hairline."
Mm-hmm.
"Can't look at you." So he said, "What are you talking?" And I got a scissor from Mac at the Harry Kalshan, was my agent in the Morris office. I had a comb, and I cut his hair, and he looked, everybody said, "You look much better." All of them. And he looked at himself, "Hey, this isn't bad." And I listened to it. His script was no good, but his hair was better.
So he did read the script after
a couple
the
of years later,
yeah,
at the Sid Caesar, we got two writers, the Simon brothers, Doc Simon, which is Neil Simon, was doing a comb over. He was very young, but he had sparse hair. And I did the same thing for him in Max Liebman's office. I gave him a comb over.
Right.
And his wife said, "Oh, this is so much nicer. You don't have..." And the same thing. And I contributed to his success as one of probably the greatest writer in our country of plays.
Yeah.
Playwright.
It could be because of the haircut. Maybe
no question.
He would have been dismissed otherwise.
No question about it. They looked at his plays instead of his hair.
You mentioned in your first book your relationship with the toupees.
Yes.
That you used to have the toupee. So it's like an ongoing theme, the hair.
Yes. I always I never wore a toupee when I went in the normal living. And I remember meeting Frederick Murray, who wore a toupee all the time, and he says, "You're not wearing a toupee. How do you decide when to wear it?" I said, "Well, it's like a tuxedo. You want to get dressed up. If you want to be fully dressed and make an impression of handsomeness, you wore a toupee." I said, "I never wear it if there's less than 1,000 people." I said, "If I go to an event and there's a few hundred people, I won't wear it." And I always made a big point of when I wore it. I would say, "I'm wearing my toupee tonight. It's an important event," you know, because I was never wanted people to look at my head. And I said it in the book. People say, "Is that a toupee you're wearing?" You'd say, "Yes." And they say, "You know, you can never tell. You can't know."
Right. It is unfair to make people stand there and wonder. It's the same. Maybe the comb over is more honest than the person with a toupee that doesn't let you know.
Yes, right.
You know, it's interesting because my generation, you don't see toupees.
No, you don't.
And you never see comb overs. So I think there are definitely people like you that made a stand at some point in history and said, we're going to be bald, and that's cool. I put Larry David in the group.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Fighters for the bald community.
Yes, be honest.
Because now people are happy to be bald. So I think you changed the world.
Maybe we're talking to one last holdout who's still has his hand right on his head right now as we're talking.
Not me, no. It's so funny. So many of your memories are in my head now.
Oh,
with the transfer of, you know, through the books, I feel like I've gotten to also live your life. I feel like I really know you. You don't know me. It's unfair.
You know, Mel, who sits there every night almost, right there, he says, "You know, I've written like 5 or 6... I don't know how many books I've written, 5, 6, 7. I wrote only one novel, which was called All Kinds of Love. And I've written, but they're all biographical. And I realize it's the easiest thing to write about. You don't have to research it. It's there. And the things pop in your head.
Why is it so important to you to preserve these memories?
It's not important. It's just fun.
It's just for fun?
Yeah, fun. I don't think it's important.
No?
It's important. It is important in the sense that I once discovered, not too long ago, that I'm really the world's MC. I'm a master of ceremonies at heart. I've been able to do it since I'm 18 years old when I went away to the mountains. I was able to do game shows and introduce people. With no script, I would just get out there and be funny. And I never have anything prepared. I just get up, and it's a gift that I have. And that's being an MC is pointing to people and saying, "Here, look at this guy. You're going to really enjoy it." Steve Allen was the biggest one for that. He loved getting to point to people and say, "Look at this guy. Look what he does." I've done that all my life, and I've done it very comfortably without ever. I never have to prepare. I never do prepare. If I prepare, it's going to come out stilted.
So having read both of your books, and I try to figure out, as any young comedian would, what makes somebody successful? What makes somebody successful in life, not just in comedy? And what struck me from your books is your ability to think very quickly on your feet.
It helps. Yes, it helps. And the same thing happens in front of the typewriter. You're thinking on your keyboard very quickly, and you're changing all the time. Somebody says you never finish an art project. You stop.
Right.
That's right. Today I was ready to type. I really improved it. There's no question about it. You're making improvements, but you can keep improving forever.
The thing that strikes me as the best example is in your first book when you talked about the FBI interrogating you as a communist.
Yes, yes.
And how quick and sharp you were with your responses.
Well, I decided right away. They were charming, and I said, "I'm going to out-charm them. If they have nothing to lean against, if they're pushing against and you're pushing back, they'll push harder. So you fall over together."
So I was reading that and I was thinking, what if I was in that situation? I imagine there would be fear.
Was definitely fear, but there's also a very good actor. I was acting fearless.
You were acting fearless, but you were fearful
inside.
Of course.
In the back of my head, I said, "My God, everything can go down." It was the McCarthy era. Sure. They were looking for communists, and there was it all started with a grocer up in New York, Rye, New York is the place, looking for communists everywhere.
I hear people talk about how now with the NSA listening in on phone calls and everything, it's becoming like that again. As somebody who's been through it, do you think that's true?
Well, unless they use it, everybody knows what everybody's doing with it. My God, your phones, it's unless somebody uses it nefariously, it doesn't matter. I don't care if they know what they know about me.
You don't think we're heading to another time like that?
I don't think so. I think it's so open that it's going to be, yeah. They will use pieces of information badly. You know, the right wing has been doing it all the time. They get a piece of almost information. John Stewart, God bless him, he puts it right out there so perfectly. And Colbert, the two guys before, and Rachel Maddow, there are certain people who know how to tell you what the truth is. Then the Fox Network makes up facts, and then they act on them. They continue to act on facts they've made up. That's why I love Mark Twain. He put it all out there for everybody. He was the best ever.
What about him specifically?
Well, he covered every subject in the world that was worth covering. And as a matter of fact, 50 years after he died, they published a thing called Letters from the Earth that was not allowed to be published then because it was blasphemous. And his wife or somebody kept it. They said it won't be published till 50 years later. They published it, and somebody asked me to read it, tape it. And it was one of the proudest things I've ever done. It doesn't sound like me. It was nothing. It was the best acting I've ever done. It was because I really morphed into Mark Twain. I was on This Is Your Life once, and they wanted to know they asked my wife, what did she give me? What kind of car? She said, he has a car. What's he like? She says, Mark Twain. So they gave me a signed copy. One of the books actually has his original manuscript pasted into the book.
Wonderful.
And 150 books. So he's the guy.
What sets him apart for you from all the other writers? What's he doing that they didn't do?
Such honesty and such humor, my gosh. I mean, if you're going to read one book in your life, read Huckleberry Finn, somebody once said. And the other one is King Arthur,
King Arthur. I've heard that one.
Yeah, that one has everything in it. If you want to know about what makes societies and governments tick, that's in it. I mean, for all time. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And he wrote a thing called What is Man? A little short book. What is Man? And I never even thought. He says, what is selflessness? What is selfishness and what is selflessness? He says, everybody fixes it. They're selfless. He says, everybody is selfish. There's very little selflessness. He said, well, what about the selfless act? He says, like if somebody saw a little kid fall in the water and you jump in to save somebody's life, isn't that selfless? No, that's selfish. You would not be able to live with yourself if you didn't do that. There are certain things you do because you know you can't live with yourself if you didn't do them, if you didn't help a person in need. And selflessness really exists.
So there is no truly selfless person, actor person.
That's what he's saying. You know, and it's a small book. What is Man? It's worth reading. Man, he told man, he talks to man. You know, man, God, man. Is it God and man or whatever?
This seems like a perfect transition into philosophy, since that's basically what we're talking about anyway. So the philosopher that I have chosen for you is somebody I'm sure you're familiar with.
I'm not.
Okay, well then,
because
it.
I haven't read many books on philosophy.
Well, do you know about Moses Maimonides?
I've heard of him. He's the big guru of our sect.
Right.
Yes. What did he say?
The Rambam.
Rambam.
He said
yeah.
a lot of things.
I knew about the Rambam.
right.
I don't know what he said. Maybe I'll know the quote you're going to get.
Well, I'll tell you why we chose him for you.
Okay.
We chose him because of your famous record with Mel Brooks, the 2,000-year-old man.
Right, right.
And I figured you're half the record.
All right.
Maimonides is 1,000 years old. That's 1,000 each. So I'll give you a 1,000-year-old philosopher.
Okay.
Half a 2,000-year-old man. Maimonides was born in 1135 and lived to 1204, 69 years, and he lived in Cairo, Egypt. Maimonides thinks that our minds are the tool to find truth, but we must accept that they are flawed tools. For example, let's examine proving the existence of God. Maimonides is a proponent of negative theory, meaning we describe God based on what he isn't. He never dies. He is not confined to one form. If we attempt to describe God by what he is, eternal, we are putting our finite vision on an infinite thing and hence doing it injustice. Well, first of all, I'll discuss with you your thoughts on God, because I...
Well, you know, I think I've got Maimonides beat. I got to figure it out.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. A long time ago, I'm a confirmed, dyed-in-the-wool atheist. I know I'm an atheist. And when people say, how can you be an atheist? I says, well, let's take God. I said, you are God. Man is God. Human beings have invented God because they needed him. I says, every thought ever done is done by man. Nobody put the thought in your head. You had the thought. A long time ago, I said, when Moses went up the side of the mountain, and there was always smart men in society, one smart guy, a little smarter than everybody else. And somebody gave this example once, and I never forgot it. They said during the Neanderthal days, human beings did not know from whence came children. Where did children come from? How did they get? It took a very smart Neanderthal to put together the sex act and the birth act. They were months apart, 9 months apart. Nobody ever said, if you do that, this happens. They didn't know it. One smart guy said, hey, this guy never did that, and he never had that. So maybe that's... And one. It's always one man who figured out something. There's always one brighter person. It has been throughout centuries. You know, we have... Freud and Marx and Christ and people who thought Moses went up on the hill, and I'm sure this is absolutely true. The synchronistic thing of a lightning striking when he's getting these ideas, I really think there was a thunderbolt when he was writing down these things, but those were his ideas. Thou shalt not, covet thy neighbor's wife, thou shalt. And I said, those things were put down. And when he came down, he said, look at the ideas I came down with. They said, who are you? He said, look at the ideas I came down that God has given me to give you because the flash of lightning came. And I said, so man needed God because there were things happening. They had nothing to know. They used to pray to rocks. They prayed to a conch shell. They picked them. Before they had monotheism, they prayed to many gods. They had crazy-looking statues they were praying to.
Do you think that means there's a need for prayer?
It's the need to know, and they don't know who will answer their really profound questions. Where did I come from? How did I get here? What are we doing here? And I said, man is God. He has figured it out. My God, the things he's figured out, we are now living to 80, 90 years old because we know how to kill diseases that used to kill you like this in the desert, my God. And people got smart very, very early on. I said, that my father used to tell me about one of the traditions in Jewish culture is when you cut your fingernails, you burn them. You put them in a thing and burn them. I said, well, where did that come from? He says, in the desert, he said, a lot of dirt on the fingernails. They said mazikum. Devils are in dirt under the fingernails, so they got to get rid of them, otherwise you'll get sick. And they knew about, figured out there was an unseen thing called mazikum, germs. And man, very way early back, man is smart. Then they figured out, they got telescopes, they invented microscopes and telescopes and all those things. So man is very, very smart, and he needed God. And I say those who use God, who doesn't exist, as for comfort, I said, it's all well and good. Whatever gives you comfort, you pray to something that's not there, but that's all right.
What do you use for comfort?
The fact that I know there's no God and I have to do it myself. You do it yourself. You have something bothering you with your foot, you go to a foot doctor. Your brain can't figure something out. There's a guy, thing called Freud, who invented psychiatry, who has now been proven that it's way, he was way off base in some things. There are a lot of improvements on him, including a guy named Beyond who came lately. And I have a daughter who just wrote a Beyond Beyond. She wrote a book. She's a psychoanalyst, and she has written about how the mind works and what it does to the body. And it's an extraordinary piece of work. So, but it's a person. It's a, I know she's a person. She's my daughter.
Have you ever prayed?
No.
Never?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, but you pray to yourself, you know. Oh, come on, let's just, yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. I don't know. It's not, I'm not praying to anything. You're hoping. That's what it is. Your hope. You're hoping that this works out.
Well, what, going back to the idea with the Jews, I always think about this as a Jew. What, why do you think we've been persecuted so much?
I have no idea. Well, you know something? People who don't have much sometimes elevate themselves by making somebody lower than them, making somebody a scapegoat for your inabilities, saying they're terrible. I think that's it. And because they were literate, I think they were very upset that they were literate and did things a lot that the pagans couldn't do. But they weren't warring. They weren't warlike at one point. At one point they were. You know, they did conquer in battle. And what was it? The Philistines and any?
Sure, the King David times.
Yeah,
we had a few good war years.
Yes, there. Absolutely.
Having fought in World War II, you must have thought about this quite a bit over the years, right?
Oh, well, my God, that was the fact that a whole millions of people could accept a maniac that Goebbels figured out a way to get all the people in the country together, united by hating something, and they pick on the Jews who were rife for hating at the time because they were different, you know, anybody. Anyway, so that was the thing I will never, ever understand, why all those people went along with it. And I never forgive them for that. And I praise those people. There was a book that just came out, I just ordered it, about a guy who was writing about against Hitler for years and years in Germany. A new book. It's been one of the biggest books in Europe for hundreds, for dozens of years. It just came here. I just ordered it. I forgot the name of it. Anyway.
I think it's interesting. I mean, I grew up, I was sent to yeshiva, so I grew up very religious and moved away from it. Now I moved back towards it. I believe that belief in God is something that's either instilled in you when you're young or not.
It's true. My father didn't go to shul or synagogue. He believed in God, but he didn't go to synagogue. And my friends all went to synagogue, and the only reason I went is to not be alone on the high holidays. I went with them. We didn't have to pay in those days. But I never took it seriously.
Do you think there's any value to any of it, the traditions or anything?
Oh, traditions are always, if the traditions have good things in them, sure they're good, you know. The tradition of getting together for dinner, for family to get to dinner, force them to get to dinner during Seder, that's lovely.
Yeah.
But to pray to somebody who doesn't even exist is, you know, is pray. Look unto yourself. Look until thine own self be true and you'll be okay. Organized religion, my first thing that comes to my mind is the Catholic Church, which they really know how to organize. My wife and I went to Mexico City one day, and we went to Guadalajara to saw that absolutely magnificent temple. We were on the Day of Ascension when people are crawling on their hands and knees to give alms to the church. These poor people, bedraggled people in tatters with their knees bleeding, crawling the last mile to the church with a little token of money which they laid on the church's step. And I'm saying, and I'm looking at this gold door, and I'm saying, there it is. There's what you, yeah. That's ridiculous. The Pope is walking around with these gold shoes and a gold hat, and millions of people are praying to him. And what do they get back? They get back peace.
Right.
He will give you peace. Eternal peace.
So you never believed in your whole life?
No.
Even as a kid?
And a kid, I probably did. I mean, because I went to show him. I probably didn't. No, my father said he did, so I guess I did.
Well, I'm going to keep reading the Maimonides stuff.
Yeah, okay.
We can keep analyzing it. There is one disease which is widespread and from which men rarely escape. The disease varies in degree in different men. I refer to this, that every person thinks his mind more clever and more learned than it is. I have found that this disease has attacked many an intelligent person. They express themselves not only upon the science with which they are familiar, but upon other sciences about which they know nothing. If met with applause, so does this disease itself become aggravated.
Just because somebody thinks they're smart doesn't mean they're smart. I mean, you can be educated, but not inventive smart. And those people kid themselves when they think that because they have learned all the things they were taught to learn, they had a way of digesting stuff that was invented by somebody else, and they learned it, and they became doctors, they became lawyers, judges. But people who think clearly about things innovatively, mm-hmm. those are the real thinkers. Those are the real, and most people, ordinary people, can have that and never be lauded as doctors. You know,
right? I think there's a difference.
Common sense.
Between being clever and being intelligent,
and being educated, you can be clever and you can be educated and be very dumb too.
Give me an example.
Well, learning things by rote, really understanding what makes people tick, what makes things tick. It's a rare gift, and some people who have degrees have that, but most people don't. I don't think.
Do you think the older you get, the more you understand?
If you understood it a little at the beginning, you will, and continue on that path. If you never understood, you will never understand. And you will think you understand and make fun of people who think they understand.
Right. So you have to have something to build on. Are you still as young in your mind as you were?
I think so. I think so, because I'm able to come up with things that are new for me. And so... At 92, if I can do that, I will stay around as long as that keeps going.
What about marriage? In this business of comedy, so many fail, and how do you balance a brilliant career in show business like you did and a good relationship? Is there a trick to that?
Yeah, sure there is a trick. My wife, you once said it. Somebody asked of her, right there, sitting there, what makes a good marriage? She says, how do you live so long? She says, marry someone who can stand you. Now you can stand. Who can stand you? If you can stand all the little peccadilloes, you don't leave.
Right.
And you hang in there because you marry that person for a reason in the first place, and you forget it sometimes because so many things come into the mix, positive and negative things. But... where are you going? If you get divorced, you'll only do it again. You make the same mistake twice. Now, we were married for 65 years, and they were great, great years. To this day, I made a little adage in one of the books. You notice the new adage, which is 70 is the new 65. When people ask me how long I've been married, I say 65. And one day it occurred to me, he's right, my wife was married 65 years, but I'm still married. She's still within me. I think of her all the time. So I'm married 70 years. So I'm saying that's the new adage. 70 is the new 65. And sadly, you can apply, you can change it to 50 is the new 45, or sadly, 12 is the new 7, you know, depending on how long
right. You
stay married before one passes on.
As I get older, I feel like time moves faster.
It does, no question about it.
So at 92, does it continue to
no,
move?
No, I think it's slowing down. No. It doesn't. No, it doesn't. I don't think it moves faster. I'm moving slower. That's what it is. Yeah. I really move slower, and I'm very aware of it when I walk around a block. Very aware of it.
I found it fascinating in your book how you talked so much about how you think about your own mortality. One line in your book that made me laugh out loud was the idea that the mortician would admire your toenails.
Yeah, a long time ago. When I used to run around the track at Beverly Hills High, I was running a mile a day for every day. And I had fine-looking toenails, and all of a sudden I got ingrown, and they were. And I had to go to the podiatrist, and he says, "Wait a second." I said, "What happened?" He says, "You're wearing the wrong size shoe." I said, "I'm wearing a 10, which is my size." He says, right. 10 and a half is your size. You're banging up against the shoe when you run. So I got a bigger shoe, and he gave me something to put on the nail. It took years till they straightened out again. So both nails look good, and I put this little stuff on it, but I have shoes that fit. So I said, they look perfect. And I took pictures of it. I said, someday a mortician is going to say, look at a 92-year-old man, or 95, whatever. Or
yeah.
He's got very young nails.
Hopefully he's as attentive to detail as you are.
I says, well, if he reads this, if he gets a chance to read the book, he'll find out how he can have a young nail.
Yeah. I think anytime, if I was a mortician, anytime I had someone die who had a book out about their life, I'd want to read it before. Yeah. But also, you're a comedian. You pick apart the little things. I don't know that most people do that. I don't know that most people would pay attention to the toenails.
Yeah.
If a comedian was taking care of the body, almost 100% they would say that.
Yeah, you think about everything.
Why do you think we do that as comedians? Why do we observe
That's why we're comedians. That's why people enjoy comedians, because they do notice the things that people would have noticed, did notice, but didn't take note of. You know, they've been passing by, but you point it, and they start thinking about, oh, my God, I have the same thing. And they laugh. They laugh in recognition that you're talking about them, talking
right.
about their relation to their wife, their relation to their kids.
What if we were just called noticers instead of comedians?
Yeah, noticers, right.
Well, this next noticer, he notices a lot. You're going to love this guy.
Yeah.
Nothing gets past him.
Yes.
Well, talking about the big questions that you say people invent God to answer these big questions, what do you make of them? What do you think is the purpose of life? What do you think?
That's the point. The purpose of life, as far as I'm concerned, is not to foul the atmosphere or to send nourishing people into the world, bring children into the world with a good sense of values that do not oppress other people, just a good people, and by example make for a better world.
For the sake of discussion, I'll ask you why is it important to have a good world?
Well, we have one planet, and the way we don't think, I'm thinking about the guy who reads about, says the planet is doomed to die within 9 million years, or 9 billion, whatever, 9 billion years.
Right.
And he says, what did he say? He said 9 billion. Oh, I thought he said 9 million. Yeah. I don't know why we think.
Yeah. What do you make of death? What do you think?
Death is it's going into the best sound sleep you've ever had, where you really sleep and you wake up in the morning, you don't have you've had no dreams, and just come from, you fall asleep, and that's it. There's nothing.
I really think there's a part of you that's very poetic, not just the one about Lois, but there's definitely a poetry to the way you write. One line from your book that stuck with me, that I thought was particularly poetic, was, "I'm happy every day that I have a shadow."
Yeah, well, I was leaning on the wall and I saw my shadow, and I said, "Oh, if you have a shadow, you're alive." You know, you always look for signs of life in your aging body.
Yeah.
I have a whole slew of indications you're on your way out. Yeah,
you're checking out.
Checking out. Yeah,
I like that one.
Yeah,
we've talked on the show before about Carlin and the euphemisms, the passing away.
Yeah,
checking out's a good one.
Yeah,
checking out.
I have a chapter I love, the title of "Checkups Are Late Checkouts," because one day I found out I had just accidentally, I had appointments with four or five doctors. All right. Accidental. One was a hearing doctor, one was a right. foot doctor, one was a for my ear something. But there was just accidentally, I saw it in my book. I said, how did they all come on one day? So, and I realized, but the more times you check up, you check out, you're probably putting years onto your life. So check ups, allay check outs. That was a good title chapter.
Yeah, I like that one. And how you got nine in 2 days.
The interesting thing is I could never think of the word allay after that. I was saying, what the hell's the name of that chapter? I never used the word LA.
Right.
So the words come to you as you need them. They store in a place that is cold storage until you, for some reason, your brain starts heating up, melts the cold storage, and words flop down out of the cold storage that you never knew you knew. That's always a thing that surprises me. I didn't know I knew that word.
Yeah, it's all up there.
I even know how to spell it.
Yeah. I felt good as an overweight guy when I read about the shadow. I thought, hey, I got a lot of shadow.
By the way, I'm going to talk to you about your overweight before you leave. Every time I read about it, you're cutting years off your life. Mm-hmm. And when you find out there is a way to do it that makes sense, it's unbelievable. I mean, I'm watching, I just happened to see Maria Osmond. She was like this. And there are so many ways to do it, but you got to do it because you're cutting years of your life, and you obviously got a lot of work to do yet.
I know, I do.
Do you think about?
I try all the time. I just enrolled in another eating disorder program.
Okay,
it's a constant battle for me.
Well, keep at it, and think in terms of smaller portions and fish and chicken instead of, and forget about this, steaks and chops. Just throw them out, and no butter. You know, all that, throw them. And there are things that are satisfying, you know, the sherbets instead of ice cream, you know, and things like that.
I knew you were going to bring this up when I came in here because you fixed the guy's hair. And
No, this is
right.
Yeah, but you and I'm so and
you're
I'm,
a fixer-up guy.
And I wouldn't say it to anybody, but you really have a purpose, a purpose on earth that I applaud. I think it's wonderful what you're doing, the stuff you're doing. And I'd like you to continue to do it longer than you want to do it. longer than you're primed to do it.
All right. Better than longer than you want to do it. Then I'm just going to be doing it for a bunch of years. I appreciate that. Thank you, Carl.
I'm not kidding. And I've learned it. By the way, I learned that if you cut down the portions, because I have to cut down portions because I had this endoscopy where there had something in my stomach that was almost did me in. It's very satisfying eating portions, small portions, eating it slowly, and have two or three, four or five times a day, but small portions like this instead of this.
Maybe we'll do a follow-up interview and I'll be in better shape.
Okay.
Maybe I could be the next Neil Simon.
Yes.
I feel like there's a magic to when you save people.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about work ethic, because even when it comes to Twitter, you talk about how you set aside 10 minutes before you go to sleep to write tweets.
Yeah.
So how did you develop such a good work ethic?
I don't know. It's pleasurable. These are things that please me. I sit down at the computer. I look at the email. I look at the Twitter to see if I have to. I do a couple of games of solitaire. And I get to work, sometimes reverse. I work and then do that after. But before I go to bed, I always play a couple of games of solitaire.
Do you think that's just to keep your mind sharp?
I didn't realize it, but it does keep your mind sharp. It keeps your eyes and mind coordinated. Mm-hmm. You have to, look at that, boom, boom. And I love when you have move things around.
Before I go to bed every night, I play this game called Rubik's Race, where you have to solve a Rubik's Cube very quickly.
That's too much.
But it's the same thing. It is.
That's
just something to keep.
Absolutely. But it's also mind-hand coordination, because you're on a keyboard and you're looking at,
And I figured out when I play the game before I go to sleep, I have much more vivid dreams. Do you get strong dreams when you?
Sometimes, yeah. Not every time, and I wish I did, because I go to a psychiatrist once a week, and last week I didn't have any dream.
Do Do you remember your dreams?
I put them down if I don't.
Write them down?
Yeah, if you don't write them down, I forget them.
I have three quotes here from Maimonides, and that's the end of the show.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Do not consider it proof just because it is written in books, for a liar who will deceive with his tongue will not hesitate to do the same with his pen. So he's saying, in other words...
Oh, yeah, well, that's absolutely true. And today, Maimonides would have to say about television. And as soon as you read that, I'm seeing the Fox Network.
Yeah.
They come up with things and they tell you they're true and they're not.
Sure, they can present the same idea in different mediums, and you'll believe it more or less based on how you
right.
see it.
So Maimonides would be very, very, very active today if he were on television.
I think if he was around now, you'd probably go see him, if only for the medical. He was a doctor as well.
I know, Rambam. I love that name, Rambam.
I told Kylie I'd love to name a kid Rambam. It's a good, strong
name. It's giving him a big responsibility.
Yeah. I think on his grave site, it said, from Moses to Moses, there was no one like Moses.
I was just watching the, what's the name of the Moses picture? Ten Commandments. Mel and I were finished watching it last night. What a piece of extraordinary work as far as the technical things in it.
Yeah.
The artwork and the... Unbelievable, but the story, you know, is just silly.
I'm surprised nobody's remade it.
You can never redo it like that. Oh my God, it's the most elaborately structured piece of filmmaking ever. I mean, the sets alone and the props. I've never seen anything like it. It's worth looking at.
What attracted you to directing films?
So I wrote a couple of films. Couple films that were directed by people, and I watched the film and I said, oh, why'd he do that? Why'd he do that? Why'd he go close up on the head? It's a two shot. You want to see the guy reacting. You don't want to cut to the reaction. You want the audience to look and laugh. You cut to the reaction, you're saying, laugh. They won't laugh if you do that.
Right.
Somebody directed a couple of the first films I wrote, and I said, I better direct. So when I wrote the screenplay of a book, Enter Laughing, mm-hmm. I decided I would direct it just so I would be able to protect the script.
That's why I edit the show myself, this show.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly right. And editing is the...
I think editing is almost as important, if not more, than the writing or the performance.
You do it in your writing. You edit all the time.
Right.
And that editing is the final polish that nobody can...
I think a bad editor can destroy a great film.
There's no such thing as a bad editor. You get rid of that guy.
Is there a secret to show business? I'm sure you've been asked before, but
tell the truth.
It's very abstract. I mean, the business, I don't... Oh. You know, I just moved out from New York not long ago, and so Hollywood, to me, it's just this big monster that I don't understand, but you've known it for your whole life. Well,
Well, show business?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. First of all, there's some of the nicest, wonderful people here. When you laugh, you have a good... Your product, you enjoy it as you make your product. You know, what other product do you make over and over again that you enjoy? Because you never make it over and over again. You're making something new each time. You're on a belt line making automobiles. You're making fenders. Same thing. But in show business, you're making new things all the time.
Do you think you'll direct another movie?
No. You get of an age. It's directing a movie is two things. It's social directing. It's keeping everybody happy on the set and being there. For 12 hours a day, and then going into the editing room. No, I think I stopped directing when I was in my 80s or something.
It's too taxing.
Oh, it is taxing. I don't think there's any 90-year-old directors.
You talk about in this book all the character actors that are forgotten, and then you find out that they died, and it makes you happy that they had a family. And
yeah, like for instance, little known. I just happened to read the obits, and I'm reading about a little known you know, and I read the movies in a lot of movies because some of these actors, little small parts in a lot of movies. And then at the end, you see he had a good life. He had a wife and children with it. He never made it as a star, but he obviously had a star life as a husband and father.
But it doesn't tell you in the obituary how many days he walked around the house full of anxiety and fear.
No, that everybody has that.
Do you?
Anxiety, I have, sure.
Really?
Well, at this age, you wonder how and when you're going to go. Yeah, you don't want to go hitting your head on the ground.
Why? Why does it matter?
It doesn't matter. But you don't want to go in a hospital. That's what I would. I said, don't. If I have to go to a hospital, give me a.
So what's the trick to stay young and keep going? Is it just
have something you get up for? I get up for, and I say, I have my. If I didn't have the computer to go to, I don't know what I would get up for. Watch television. Jeopardy is fun, you know, but not enough.
I was so excited to wake up today. I love days when I can't wait to wake up just because I got to do this today.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
This makes it a special day. It was marked on my calendar. And
well, I had two things that I did today. I got new hearing aids.
Wonderful.
Without them, I... Well, that's another thing. You take your hearing aid out at night and it's so quiet. Mm-hmm. It's very quiet.
Well, that's good. At least you get sound sleep.
Men's hearing goes earlier than women's for some reason. I don't know why.
Say that again? But at times the truth shines so brilliantly that we perceive it as clear as day. Our nature and habit then draw a veil over our perception, and we return to a darkness almost as dense as before. What do you make of that?
That's people who are so involved with themselves that they can't accept the pleasures that are happening to them from the outside, like a clear day, a beautiful day. Yeah. When your burdens are heavy, the clear day doesn't seem to do much except make them seem heavier.
Well, that goes back to the anxiety, what we were talking
about. Yeah, right.
How do you alleviate the anxiety? What works best to clear your mind?
Zopatan. I don't know. I don't know. Well, that's one of my things that I laugh at so much when they give these new drugs. And it's do not take this drug if you are prone to sleep 8 hours a day, eat food, go to the toilet, and breathe air and drink water when you're thirsty. If you have any of those symptoms, this will kill you.
Right. Yeah. Here's the last quote from Maimonides. He says, "You must accept the truth from whatever source it comes."
You must accept it, sure, of course. Why not?
Yeah, I don't think you needed to tell me
that. Yeah, sometimes the truth will come from a child who doesn't know he's come up with something.
Sometimes they have a clearer perception of the world than because they haven't been fed enough lies.
Yeah, or they...
Do you think that's what it is?
Could be, or they may be forced to taste the water that is brackish and say, "This water brackish."
I have some lines that I'll close on about memories.
Go ahead.
To plug the books, I Remember Me and I Just Remembered.
And the new one, I had almost forgotten.
Here's a few from a bunch of different philosophers. We each need to make peace with our own memories. We have all done things that make us flinch. And that's Surya Das. Memory is a child walking along a seashore. You never can tell what small pebble it will pick up and store away amongst its treasured things. And that's Pierce Harris. Everybody needs his memories. They keep the wolf of insignificance from the door. That's Saul Bellow.
He was nice. He was good.
Memory itself is an internal rumor. That's George Santayana. Every man's memory is his private literature. That's Aldous Huxley.
Beautiful. That is absolutely perfect for me, isn't it? I better put that down. Jesus, because if that isn't what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Mel was pointing out that all I write about is my own life. Boy, is that... I may use that in the front of my book. I use my own. I quote myself.
Yeah.
And from a book I read, the first my anecdotal life, I quoted myself from my anecdotal life. I wrote it in the book, and I said, I'm looking for a quote like this. Couldn't find one, so I said, there's a good quote on page 37. So I quoted myself, which nobody's ever done. So, but this one now, memory is his private, geez, that's great.
And it's really true. I think we're just a compilation of our memories and how we perceive them anyway, right. You know?
Private Literature by Aldous, A-L-D-U-S, huh?
Yeah, A-L-D-O-U-S.
O-U-S.
Huxley.
X-U-X.
You know, I did an audition for a comedy festival, and they asked me, this is a few years ago, they didn't get a sense of who I was from my act, in my old act.
No.
And they said, well, we thought you were very funny, but we didn't really get a sense of who you are. And I realize now I should have told them, I am a compilation of all my memories and how I perceived them.
Yeah.
It's who we all are, right? That's what makes you, you, and me, me.
Absolutely. So. No question about it. And because you can do that, people say, oh, that's just like me.
And you know something? Now that I have all your memories in my memory.
Yes, it's your memory.
Now in some way, you and I are alike.
Exactly.
That's interesting. And then the last one here is, the past is never dead. It is not even past. And that's William Faulkner.
Faulkner, he's good too.
Yeah.
Past is never dead if somebody remembers it.
That's the show, Carl. Thank you so much for doing it. And I appreciate you having me here and taking the time.
This is it? You mean we're finished? I haven't even started to tell you things that I've been thinking all week. Oh, dear. Can you come back tomorrow? This is so disappointing. Did I sing you my Scottish? I didn't even sing you my Scottish song.
Well, yeah, give me an Irish song.
All right, forget it. Forget it. I'm very disappointed. Very disappointed.
Thanks so much, Carl.
I bet you never got one of those.
No, that was a great sign-off. A master of ceremonies and sign-offs.
Yeah.
All right, that's our show, everybody. I want to thank Alex Fasella, as always, for picking out some fantastic philosophers. I want to thank our wonderful guest, Mr. Carl Reiner, the great Carl Reiner, and I want to thank you guys for tuning in. I want to thank our sponsors. You know what? I'm going to stop saying I want to thank, and I'm going to start thanking. So I thank our sponsors, Tent Encounters with Jewish Culture. Remember, if you're interested in thinking more about why so many Jews have been involved in comedy, go and check out www.tentsite.org. It's a chance for you to meet some great collaborators, workshop your own stuff, talk to leaders in the field, see some great shows, and learn a lot. Deadlines are coming up soon, and space is limited, so get on it right now. I can't recommend it enough. And please go check out standupcrap.com and pick up some wonderful comedy albums. Pick up my album, Some Kind of Comedian. Support Dan Schlissel, support standupcrap.com, and go get some wonderful stand-up stuff. You want to hear more Carl Reiner? I know that you do. He's on my buddy Mark Malkoff's podcast this week, also the Carson podcast, which I've talked about a little bit before on this program. Mark Malkoff talks to people whose lives were changed by their experience being on The Old Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and some fantastic stories come out of that. So go and check out the Carson podcast. And Mark Malkoff is a phenomenal host, and I think you're going to love it. You can email me at thecomical@yahoo.com. I love hearing from you. Please be in touch, and if you are in touch, stay in touch. And if you have a little bit of time on your hands this week, it would mean a lot to me if you could jump on iTunes and leave 5 stars and a nice review. That would help the show, and it would help me. So please do that. Make a donation at moderndayphilosophers.net. If you send me $20 or more, I'll send you some complimentary Tweaked Audio earbuds, which you can also find at tweakedaudio.com. And if you want to buy them there, use promo code MDP for 1/3 off and free shipping. Can't go wrong. Okay, everybody. That is about it. I want to leave you now with a beautiful song from the late, great Estelle Reiner off her album Hurry Home. The track is called The More I See You. The lyrics are by Mark Gordon and the music is by Harry Warren. So enjoy that, and I'll see you guys next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.
more I see you, more I want you. Somehow this feeling just grows and grows. With every sigh, I become more mad about you, more lost without you. And so it goes. Can you imagine how much I love you? The more I see you, as years go by, I know the only one for me can ever be you. And my arms won't free you, and my heart won't try. The more I see you, the more I want you. Somehow this feeling just grows and grows. With every sigh, I become more mad about you, more lost without you. And so it goes. Can you imagine how much I'm